Question number one. Dear Ajahn, may we request for a recording of tomorrow night's chanting with a microphone, please? It can be then included together with the recordings of the Dhamma talks and questions and answers. Right, sister's not going to be here tomorrow. She's got to give a talk. Ah. So, if you want to, you can do. Let's see what happens. Okay. It's up to the recorder. Do you want to record it tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Chanting? Okay. Dear Ajahn, if one cannot accomplish first jhana in this very lifespan, then I think it's a big crisis. Oh, why do people make such a big thing about this? You don't know yet whether you're going to accomplish it or not. It might be just around the corner. It may be this evening. So what's a big crisis? Don't worry about anything. Just do it. Or rather, don't do it. So Ajahn, are there many such householders nowadays who accomplish first jhana? He who knows doesn't say. He who says doesn't know. Ajahn, what is your advice, apart from making a meditation, to increase one's chance of being a stream winder in this lifetime? Be quiet. Be still. And don't ask silly questions. No, it's just, the thing is that we always worry about how we're going to do it, when we're going to do it. And every time we think, how are we going to do it, when we're not going to do it, we don't do it. Always thinking about something else, some other time. When is it going to happen? And as long as you're thinking, when's it going to happen, it never happens, because you're not looking at the present moment. You're looking about something else. And every time you say, it's not going to happen, you're spoiling the opportunity. It's your job as a gardener, sort of developing your mind, is just to look after the seedlings. It will grow in its own time. You do not need to worry. In the suttas, Ajahn Chah used to use this simile. He said that once there was this little worm, and he was eating away at the earth, and one day he think, my goodness, there's millions of other worms. We're all eating this great earth. One day we'll eat the earth away. And he got into a crisis. That's a silly thing. Because sure, they eat something, but then they sort of excrete, and that becomes the earth again, they eat it again. Just like us. You know, we sort of, you know, eat our food today, we excrete it, it goes into the soil again, comes fertilized, and we eat it again. So you don't have to worry about these things coming and going, it's just anicca. So, you get jhanas, don't worry about it. Ajahn, we know how the body comes about. How did the mind come about? When you ask that question, your mind came about. If you're absolutely still, then your mind disappears. So that's how your mind came about. You disturbed the world. That makes sense? So, whoever knows how the mind comes about, I've told you how it is deconstructed, how it uncomes. Ajahn, what sutta do you personally recommend to improve one's learning in Buddhism? The name of the sutta. The Heart Sutta. Now, I don't mean the Mahayana one. I mean your Heart Sutta. So you look inside of yourself, and there you see the heart of everything. So read your inner being, your innerness, and there you'll find the greatest teachings of the Buddha. So that's my favorite sutta, the Heart Sutta. But not, you know, the Heart Sutta in Mahayana, the Heart Sutta of meditating, being still, and reading this moment. Dear Ajahn, can you please say something about Dhamma work? Do you think it's important for Buddhists to contribute within their means in this area? Sure, if there was no one who actually cooked the food, who organized this retreat, who cleaned the place up afterwards, where would you be? So it's great to do Dhamma work and to help out, to be kind, to be generous, to be compassionate. And then where you make up enough merit, then you just sit down. And sometimes you're someone who's just worked. And you've looked after other people meditating. And you've organized retreats. And then one day it's your retreat. And sometimes you think, oh, all these other people have done so much more meditation than I have. They've done all these hours and hours and hours while I've been organizing things. But what happens? You've got the bigger karma. So they have been traveling a long time, but they've been only got a bicycle. You, because of your good karma, can buy a Ferrari. So sure, they start ahead of you, but vroom, and you go way past them on this retreat. And it happens that way because, you know, when you do lots and lots of good karma, you know, your vehicle, you know, the three vehicles, the bicycle vehicle, sort of the, say, the Volkswagen vehicle and the Ferrari vehicle. Now, you're on the Ferrari vehicle on this retreat. You make lots and lots of good merit and boom, all the way to Jhana's enlightenment. So, it's not, no joke. Every person, well, people actually get these deep meditations. As I said, you can actually tell who they are because they're the kind, generous, selfless, they work hard, they don't think about themselves. They're the ones who can just let go. Something needs to be done, they're there to help out. They know how to let go. So we need for Dhamma work. You've got to let go. Just, you know, you're busy, okay, I don't matter. This is more important, you just go and do it. You don't care about sort of people criticizing you, you just go and do it. So you can just let go and apply yourself to the task at hand. So someone says, you know, can you sort of organize a talk for Ajahn Brahm? You just go and do it. Someone says, can you just go and watch the breath? You just do it. You don't think about it. Ah, it's difficult. Should I do it this way? Should I do it that way? You just go and do it. So you become selfless, pure-hearted. And then when the nimitta comes up, all that beautiful good karma, it's just such a beautiful nimitta, so peaceful and so happy. Where did that come from? All your Dhamma work. That's why the Buddha actually said, even to monks, monks, even you should make good karma. How much more so people in the lay life? Because your good karma is the energy of your mind. And when you get into this deep state, when the body disappears, then you find out, you know, what this citta really is. And if you've been a really, really good person, your citta is radiant, it's beautiful, it's powerful. So that's where you find the fruit of all your Dhamma work. So chances of Dhamma work also depend upon one's spiritual karma. Yeah, thank you. It does indeed. So you've all got amazing spiritual good karma to be able to have the opportunity to put money in the karma bank. And now is the time to draw it out. I applaud you for asking Ajahn Wayama to lead the chanting. I never heard anyone clap me. It is a display of humility. Actually, it's a display of laziness. That is so. Which I hope other bhikkhus are able to follow. This certainly shows Buddhism well in this day and age. Perhaps as opening ceremony chanting for the global conference can feature this. Question: when you make an aspiration to take the path, does your bad and good karma ripen faster? It seems to. A lot of people sort of think that idea that once you start walking the path, all your bad karma comes up. I think that shows a lot of negativity to people. That never happened to me. When I started life in the path, all my good karma came up. Had a wonderful time. I think it's a case of do, when you have a chance to go for a walk, do you go to the gas works or do you go to the garden? You know, when you're looking for things, do you also always see the faults and the rotten stuff and the difficult stuff and the mistakes, and you're always criticizing the Buddhist society or this retreat or Ajahn Brahm or Sister Wayama or those monks or that food or place? There's always the same talk, the bad jokes, the attitude, chanting. We do all the same. Can we do something different for the chat? If you're someone like that, you know, you're the person who likes gasworks. But if you're the person who says, oh, isn't it wonderful to see all these holy monks and nuns up here meditating? Oh, isn't it great to be part of this? And all these people, I saw someone today and they were sitting so still. Oh, sadhu, sadhu, isn't it great? It doesn't matter if I can't do anything. Isn't it wonderful? All these other people are getting into jhana, they're getting enlightened, and there's incredible food here, and this lady Bianca comes and cooks it all for no money at all. She's just doing it out of love. She really wants to help other people have a retreat. And these Catholics, they let us use this place. Isn't it wonderful what they're doing? And, you know, East people, oh, it's so wonderful. And if you like that, you've got sort of the beautiful mind. And people who have that type of beautiful mind, when they ordain, this is that inclining towards a good karma. Have a wonderful time. so they don't tend to get bad karma. They just don't resonate with it. They just get happy and enjoy things, and things usually go well for them. Sometimes people look for their bad karma and they bring it on. Sometimes, I know that was sometimes with sickness. Sometimes monks get sick because they don't have to practice. They've got another excuse just to, you know, do something else. But sort of, if you have a happy mind, you don't tend to get sick, and you just enjoy yourself, go and practice. So I don't really think that's the case, that once you ordain you have to endure all the bad karma. I think that's a bit of a cop out. What do people think about that? Any comments, questions about that? No? Okay, good. They like this one. This is maybe good. To the most illustrious Ajahn Bhamawangsa, Magnifico, Knight, Templar of the Order of Saint Buddha, Tobacco. Will there ever be cessation in the realm of shower takers for one who dwells in the hell? Yes. When you stop bothering about them, then the shower takers will disappear into the void. As long as you're worried about the shower takers will always be there for you. Like someone, you know, just imitating you until you've done with the shower taking lesson. Once you've learnt that, it's no longer a problem for you, and they disappear. You don't even listen to hear it anymore. What you're bothered about, that you're always hearing it. You know what it's like, actually, because, you know, you start listening. Is the shower going in? Is the shower going in? You send out your mind for it. So if you don't even worry about it or think about it, it just disappears. What is important for you is what you hear. What doesn't really bother you, you don't hear it at all. No, just leave it alone. So, but I like the most illustrious bit. No, I don't. That's just messing around. So, to the least illustrious. No, I'm making it up. Dear Ajahn, for several years now, I have bought or borrowed CDs of the Friday night talks from my mum. Some nights I can hear her laughing with the headphones on. I figure it's at one of your jokes. One of the nice things about old people, they've got a bad memory, so when I can tell the joke again and again and again, I just like a fresh joke. So I love teaching old people. So I tell the Friday night talks with my mum. Some nights I can hear her laughing with the headphones on. I think it's one of your jokes. Some Fridays she will remind me to get her some more CDs. Recently, however, I bought her the guided meditation CD. She said her mind is going crazy. So I said it's normal in the beginning and laugh. I want to share this because she is a devoted Catholic who says her prayers every morning and night. I feel happy she's open to Buddhism. Thank you. I think sometimes that if a person never knows silence before, it does feel like craziness at first because they're out of control. And they're so used to controlling things, and when you sort of get silent, it's weird. So yeah, she might feel she's going crazy, but after a while she feels that she's going sane. And at last you get some peace in her head. It's very nice that she laughs at my jokes. I wonder if that's, you know, after she went crazy, she'd ask him my joke, not before. Dear Ajahn, please could you describe in detail the factors necessary to get on the path to stream winning? Come to the retreat. Next question. Now, the factors of stream winning. What is it? There are the five factors which help stream winning. I mentioned this before in some of the questions. Number one is sila, precepts. So be a virtuous person. Keep your precepts. And don't think, well, maybe just, you know, just a little bit of wine, you know, it's good for the health. Don't think like that. Even a small flame will burn your finger. So why the smaller man, just leave it alone, have some apple juice or a cup of tea or non-alcoholic wines. It's such a fortunate age to live in these days. You can have a wine with your dinner, but it's non-alcohol, it tastes just the same. Isn't it amazing? So be virtuous, that's number one. But don't just be virtuous on the outside, be virtuous on the inside as well. So don't think, I really want to kill my husband, I want, I can't, the Buddhist is really. Oh, like was it a Thai fisherman story which I was told when I was a young monk? Because in Thailand it's supposed to be a Buddhist country, they're not supposed to kill anything, but they eat a lot of fish. Where do the fish come from? And I asked the villagers, say, oh no, we don't kill the fish, we just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. So be careful of that sort of thing. So keep your virtuous precept properly. Number two is actually learn some of the Dhamma, like what you're doing here. But with the learning also comes questioning, and that's why you know that you're always encouraged to ask questions, and even personal questions, as long as it's not beyond my ability because of the vinaya. So you can ask even deep questions and challenging questions and say, look, I don't agree with that because it says in this sutta something else. What do you think of that, Ajahn Brahm? And ask the deepest questions and never feel that you're offending someone when you ask a deep question. If a monk or a knows their business, they will never get offended at sort of a deep question. They will actually sort of be very, very thankful that someone is listening and is really concerned to know. So never feel that you can offend someone by asking a question. Ask it. So that's, with those two, it's called sutta and sakaccha. It means like your study, literally means listening to teachings or reading them, experiencing them, and then discussing them to make sure you got it right. And the fourth and fifth factors are samatha vipassana, the calm and the inside. Those five factors come together that supports, that energizes the insights of streamlining. So that's what you've got to do. Keep precepts and tick them off. Precepts, how are they? Sort of good, not good enough. When really strong, you're learning, understand, read some of the books, read some of the suttas, now listen to the talks, get the CDs, and then discuss them. Ask questions of your monks and nuns, ask them of each other, people who have what experience, and then do the practice, samatha vipassana, together, and then chances are you'll be a streamliner. Okay, dear Ajahn, for those of us who can't stop their minds chattering, would it be a good idea to become one with God? I pray to Jesus and reconvert to Buddhism after getting first jhana. That's just a joke, they said. That might be a good idea. Good. Now you still be chattering. So it's a very good idea, it's interesting. But the point is, just making yourself one with God, sort of praying to Jesus, take me over Jesus, or whatever else it is, then, okay, it's a type of letting go. But if you do get into jhana, you'll be stuck afterwards. And they'll probably make you a saint and take you to a monastery or a nunnery. But the best thing, this is, if you've got a chattering mind, there's other ways of stopping the chattering mind. First of all, why does the mind always chatter, 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 chatter? It's either because of fear, so be courageous, or it's because of discontent, you know, because you're not happy, so you just fill the mind up, fill the emptiness up with all this rubbish. So develop a positive mind, you can see the beauty in the silence, really relax, and the thoughts stop by themselves. The other reason why the thoughts keep on going is literally because you try to stop them. When you are negative to the thoughts in the mind, that negativity, the lack of contentment, feeds them even more. Remember that story I told when I was having all of these thoughts about the ex-girlfriend, fantasies and stuff, and I tried to stop my mind and it got worse, and then I said, okay, you can do whatever you want from 3 to 4 the rest of the time, behave yourself. It wouldn't behave itself, but from 3 to 4 when I said, you can do whatever you want, everything went quiet. and I stopped feeding it negativity, the fuel source was turned off, and so I stopped thinking. When you make peace with the thinking mind can't go on any longer. It hasn't got any fuel left, the negativity. So you just make peace. Whatever thought's going on in the mind, allow it to be. The door of my heart's open to you. I make peace with you. I'm not trying to control you anymore. Nothing to do with me, not my business. Then it all stops. Instead of turning on the brake, pushing the brake pedal, you just turn off the gas. No petrol, the car stops. That's a wonderful way of stopping the chattering mind. And remember, I said this first of all, the very first day. I keep on repeating it, because one of the biggest problems for meditators, chat, chat, chat inside. Think, think, think. The reason when they come to meditate, they try and stop thinking. Come on, stop thinking, stop thinking, stop thinking. And that's the reason why they can't stop thinking. The old story of those four monks keeping a vow of silence, you know the one. One sneezed, and the other one said, bless you. Second one said, you've broken your vow of silence. Third one said, aha, so have you. And the fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. The point is, as soon as you try to do something, you're disturbing the silence. Every comment disturbs the silence. So if you've got a thought coming and you say shut up, there's another thought you have to shut up, and it just goes on and on and on. Leave it alone. Don't even make a comment about the thoughts. Leave them alone, let them be. Make peace with them. And then they stop. And if you know how to do that, you can stop them very quickly. You can literally stop them in the tracks. Make peace. See? It's easy, isn't it? Yeah, you got a question. Aha. Frivolous talk. You know that I speak a lot of frivolous talk. So am I breaking my precept by being frivolous? I've taken frivolity to new heights as a monk. But the point is, it's not frivolous talk, it's pointless talk. Point which doesn't have a purpose. Talk for just talk's sake. And you know, I was quite sort of surprised to see Ajahn Chah telling jokes. All these other great monks sort of messing around. Isn't that frivolous speech? And then I figured out, no, this is important. Because if I was so serious all throughout this retreat, you'd get so tense and bored, fed up, you won't have any joy, and your meditation would really suffer. You tell a few little jokes, make a bit of fun, you lighten up, you get energy up, and your meditation improves. So all the frivolity is for a purpose. I'm also just encouraging playfulness. Because when you actually, this is something I learned as a scientist. In the physics lab, they say, when you have an experiment, play with it, play around. Do strange things, it's like a child does. It's amazing, that way you can actually see things which you've never done before. Playfulness is very creative. And if you're going to find insights, see things which you've never seen before, see new aspects on reality, you've got to be playful. So I like the idea of playfulness. You play around with meditation. That's why, you know, I invented the backwards meditation. Breathe out first, then you breathe in. Or playing around with your toothbrush, you know, start from this side and then that side tomorrow and this side. Whatever it is, do things a little bit differently. And then you're not a creature of habit, you've got life. Playfulness gives you energy and life, doing new things in different ways. So I encourage that. So it's not frivolity for frivolity's sake. It has a purpose behind it. Therefore, it does not break that precept. Gossip, well, gossip is actually, have you heard someone about who said what about whom and when? And if that has a purpose, that's important. You know, that's, you know, you might have overheard that someone is planning to kill me because they're fed up with my jokes, they can't stand it any longer. And if you have, You know, mates, they're using their mobile phones, ringing up the sort of the triads in Singapore. Can you come over here? We get a contract out on Ajahn Brahm. And if you hear that, I'll be very glad if you gossip and tell me about it. So there is a purpose sometimes to gossip. In other words, it's something which somebody needs to know. But if the gossip is pointless, and this is the main reason for that word, we spend a lot of time talking and there's no purpose to it at all. We're just like enjoying each other's company and chewing the fat, as they say. We're just, you know, going around just talking, and no one's really listening. And that sort of talking is a waste of time. And that's, I think, what that precept is all about. It's not actually part of the precepts, it's part of the Eightfold Path. The only part of the precept is lying. But the other part, the Eightfold Path, is more refined. Okay, the next question. Ajahn, could you please explain the significance of circumambulation? Thank you. I think someone's been going round and round and round in their head, and they think that that might be something important. And sometimes it's not important at all. Circumambulation, it was just an old way in India of paying respect to something. You just, you know, and I think one of the reasons is, you see the way we have our bare shoulder as much, it's always the right shoulder which is bare. Whenever we circumambulate, we always keep our right shoulder towards the object of reverence. It might mean to show that, look, it's bare, we've got no armament there, no weapons or anything else. So it's a sense of, like, you know, friendship, a sense of harmlessness, and a sense of, like, respect. And maybe that is why we always keep our right shoulder and we go around keeping your right shoulder to the object of worship. And that seemed to be, from the time of the Buddha, what happened. It was an actual action of worship. It was actually the word for it in Pali, dakina. And in Sanskrit, that becomes daksina. And in Thai, that becomes taxin. It's amazing how things do not become an object of worship after you change it from language to language. But that's actually where it comes from. But we do it round and round. And the importance of circumambulation, as Ajahn Chah used to teach us, if you're going around, make sure you make it an important ceremony. The ceremony is not important as the attitude you have. So I tell people, when we do circumambulation on Waisak Day here, first time round, just reflect upon the Buddha. Second time round, reflect upon the Dhamma. Third time around, reflect upon the Sangha, what it means to you. So you're not going about talking and chatting to people. It's silent, and it becomes a very silent, peaceful meditation on the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And sometimes it's very, very moving when it's silent, and you get, you know, 400, 500, 600, 700, or 1,000 people just walking around in silence with their candles, reflecting on what the Buddha means to them after all those years of being a Buddhist, and the teachings, the Dhamma, all the understanding, the truths, things you've seen in meditation, what that means to you. And lastly, the Sangha, all these great teachers you've had, what that means to you. Just reflect upon that. You get really, really inspired. And that's how we do the circumambulations. It's an act of reverence, of worship. Not just walking around for exercise, but it gives, we put, give meaning to it, and it becomes very, very powerful. That make sense to everybody? Okay. I once read somewhere where Ajahn Chah said, you should meditate when you feel like it, and you should meditate even when you don't feel like it. Please explain the significance of this statement, when the mind and our body does not feel like meditating. I don't feel like answering that question. Okay, I'll answer it. The point is, this is just entertainment on an evening. I don't know if you learn very much. Anyway, what it really means is that sometimes people can get very lazy. I'll meditate tomorrow. You know, you've got another day yet. I'll just go for enlightenment tomorrow. Today I will sleep. And I think this was especially to monks know, in these forest monasteries, because sometimes you can have it very easy as a monk. Now, all you guys, you know that another couple of days you'll be back on the treadmill at work with your family, having to work really hard. And you just don't have time to meditate like this. You don't have the atmosphere of a retreat, the teachings, the import. So for you, you don't have to really motivate you very much. Actually, usually you have to sort of slow you down to relax more because you try too hard. But sometimes in a monastery, you know, you've got your whole life to meditate. So sometimes people get a bit lazy. Well, I don't feel like doing it today. So this is what the Ajahn Chah thing was saying. Do it today. Meditate today. Go for it. So I think it's really like a monk teaching. Make sense? Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, last night you mentioned that Mara came to the Lord Buddha to accuse him of laziness when he was lying down. Why would Mara come to the Lord Buddha after he was enlightened? Thank you. Because Mara wanted to convince the Buddha that he wasn't enlightened. He was only imagining it. He was trying to catch him out. Because the idea of someone being enlightened was just, you know, just really made Mara very, very upset. So what you don't like to accept in life, you try and find fault with. It's like, you know, say for example, you know, you girls here, that your husband was enlightened. So you can't be enlightened, you didn't even come on the retreat. And you get very, very upset, you try and find fault with him. The fault-finding mind is like that, which is why that this Korean nun, I think, said many years ago, reported to say, if ever you do become enlightened, keep it quiet, don't tell anybody. Otherwise, you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving it. People will prod you and poke you and look at you, sneak in your room at night, see what you're doing, test you out. And it's just a pain. So he said, no, just keep it quiet and then people won't bother you. So I think that's sometimes why Mara was so upset that somebody could be enlightened, so worried and troubled by it, was following them around, wishful thinking, trying to think, I must find something. You know, just, the Buddha's not really enlightened, is he? He's not. Please, he's not. May not be enlightened. Please, please, please. And he was following them around and thought he found something. Ah, you're sleeping. But the Buddha explained why he was doing that. It was one of these brilliant answers which just Mara couldn't answer. It made sense. And it's also a brilliant answer for each one of us. Whatever arahats do, they do for the sake of all sentient beings. And sometimes that means taking a rest. Saying, no, I will not go to that place to give a talk. And that's out of compassion for all sentient beings. It's not being selfish. It's not being lazy. Because you realize that way that you will last much longer and be able to give much more. Brilliant teaching. Okay, dear Ajahn, do you have to be rid of ill will before jhana can be attained, or will only enlightenment get rid of ill will as well as craving, etc.? Okay, you have to suppress ill will to get into a jhana, but you don't abandon it, because ill will can come out afterwards, but only a long time after a jhana, because if you've been in the jhana, you're just so nice and so peaceful and so happy. People can come and call you, you are a stupid pig. You say, oh yeah, I like pigs. You're a complete idiot. Yeah, it's nice being an idiot. People just can't upset you. You feel just so happy and wonderful. Now you're ugly, you're stupid, you're a lazy bludger monk. Oh yeah, that's very nice. Thank you for even talking to me. It's very kind of you. So you just cannot get upset when you come out of a jhana. So, but after a while it all sort of falls away and then you do get upset. That's why sometimes, I never mentioned this, sometimes people who attain the jhana, if they haven't got good instructions, sometimes they think they are enlightened because they've had this amazing experience and they think, wow, this is it. They think they're enlightened, but after a while the anger comes back and they should realize that no, that's a sign enlightenment hasn't really happened. They got close, they suppressed the defilements, but the defilements are still there. But later on, after many, many jhanas, you think, you can't control anything. The will disappears. You just have loving kindness. And because you don't have all this will, to control other people, to control the country, to control whatever it is you want to do, you don't get frustration anymore. This is just what politicians are like. This is just what husbands are like. This is what monks are like. This is what nuns are like. Why get angry? Why get angry at nature? It's like getting angry at the rain for raining when you want it to be fine. Ajahn Chah's simile was, once there was a farmer who had a chicken, and he wanted that chicken to be a duck, and he had a big headache for day after day after day. Why won't my chicken go quack quack? Well, that's a very stupid farmer. Chickens are chickens, ducks are ducks. You can't change a chicken into a duck just by sort of training it to go quack quack. You just reap weariness and frustration. In the same way, we want sort of, you know, politicians, like, to be sort of like Buddhas. We want husbands, you know, to be like these beautiful, soft, caring monks. We want sort of women to be just beautiful, like supermodels. You know, we want chickens to be ducks. So that's a crazy thing. So because of that, sort of, we get ill will. Whenever you want a chicken to be a duck, you get ill will. You want your mind to get into jhana. You've got a chicken mind. You want it to be a duck mind. Isn't it causing you a lot of weariness and pain trying to get into jhana all this time? Just let go. Just let yourself be. Give it up. Stop controlling. And then you know what jhanas are. So the point is that when you want a chicken to be a duck, that's when you get ill will. All ill will is that frustration of one trying to control the world which is out of control. And when you get enlightened, when you see the Dhamma, what are you controlling for? It's a waste of time. So you don't get ill will anymore. You don't get angry. So that's how you overcome anger and ill will. At an anagami stage, a non-returner, you don't have ill will anymore. It's just gone. That's actually the signs. You can actually tell where a person's at. And that's why we always, the test is you really try hard. If you see someone who thinks they're enlightened, to really piss them off, get them upset, get them really angry, just to poke them and see what happens. And if they do, okay, you're not enlightened. You know all my stories. You know the story when I became enlightened. You don't know that one? Yeah, you know that one. There's the rotten fish curry and the pork curry. How many haven't heard that one? Put your hand up if you haven't heard it. That's enough to tell it. Well, in my fourth year as a monk in Thailand, I was meditating diligently. I was sitting long hours, staying up after all the other monks doing walking meditation. It was a rains retreat. In really good health, simple monastery, really good meditation. And then one evening, you know what it's like sometimes in meditation, everything starts to come together, you get really peaceful and you're on a roll. I didn't want to go to bed, so I started meditating and just a walking, and as I was walking meditation, all these insights came flooding into your mind. It just got so easy, because when you've got a very strong mind, it's so easy to have all these insights, and they're amazing. You're understanding everything. And then the big one came. Bang! Enlightenment. Oh, wow, this is really good, really neat. And you get all this bliss and happiness and joy, and you're just so at ease, you're floating through the air, as it were. And now I was walking backwards and forwards, having a wonderful time. It was about 1 o'clock or something in the morning. You've got to get up at 3 o'clock. So I thought I'd better go and take a rest. So I lay down, but you just lay down, not really in sleep, just perfect mindfulness as you lay down, sort of half sleep but not real sleep, always just alert and so peaceful. No thought going through your mind. And 2:30 I got up before the bell. So I went to sit in the hall there. And you're sitting there. Now usually in Thailand, in the hot, humid rains retreat, at even 3:15 in the morning, you're always nodding this way and that way. That way is just perfectly straight. Sometimes, you know, when your meditation is really hot, perfectly straight, no pain in your body at all. no thoughts going on. It's just easy. Just watch the breath, just like that. It's like picking up a piece, like an ice cream box. It's easy to do, and it just stays there. You can do whatever you want. It's just so wonderful being enlightened. I just sitting there, just having a wonderful time. Think, ah, at last, isn't it great? I'm enlightened at last. And then, it's a shame when you know the story, when you know what's going to happen in the end. And then, sort of, you know, after the morning meeting, we have to go on the arms round, and going on arms round, giving metta to all these people who are feeding in our heart, and you're making lots of good karma by putting this food in my bowl. And I felt so great, you know, so compassionate to the whole world, and nothing could upset you. And then it got there to the hall when we had our meal. Now, usually we had this real rubbish meal. This was a poor monastery in the backwoods of Thailand. Every day, usually the same food, sticky rice and rotten fish curry. They would catch the rotten fish in the rainy season and they would pickle them, and they were still using the old fish from last year. It stank, it didn't taste nice, the same every day, and it was rotten food. It literally was pickled rotten fish. And all they used to do, to tell you this is part of the story, in our monastery in Wat Nanachat, in just outside of Ubon, one day I was cleaning up around the kitchen and found one of these jars. And what they used to do, there's just no preservative. They used to bung as many fish as they can in the jar and put just some cellophane on the top. And that was it. And leave it. That was how refined they were. And I found this one. The plastic cover, that's just only cellophane, had broken and is full of maggots crawling with them. So I found it, I went to throw it away. And at that moment, the head man of the village, now this was the most educated, refined, cultured person of the lot, which is not saying very much, because when he saw that, he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm throwing away, the maggots are into it." "Don't throw it away, that's extra protein." And he got it off me. And the next morning we had rotten fish curry, and I didn't know it was that rotten fish, but I didn't sort of fancy it at all, but I had no choice. So that's the sort of food we ate. So there was a big pot of rotten fish curry as usual. But I was surprised that morning there was another pot of curry. When I looked inside, it was pork curry. Now that was actually, you know, delicious. I was a vegetarian before, but now, you know, you had to eat whatever it was. And pork curry from town, I mean, that was actually edible. And I thought, straight away, I thought, wow, why is this pork curry arrived today? At the day of my enlightenment. And I thought, this must be the Devas. The Devas are celebrating my enlightenment with this... this bowl of pork curry. Good on you, Davis. So there I was waiting for my celebratory meal of rice and pork curry, and I was second in line there. You know how it works, the senior monk gets it first of all, just like over here, that, you know, I go around the tables first of all. So the senior monk, now he was a northeast Thai, his monastery, he actually was born in the village just down the road where we'd go on arms round. He was a local guy. So I thought that, you know, he should like the local food. But no way. He just took these big ladles, not small ladles, big ladles of, you know, this pork curry and put it into his bowl. Straight away I thought, you know, that really is greedy. No one can eat that much. But it didn't matter because there was lots left. So I didn't get upset. But then what he did next... he took three out for himself, three big ones, okay? He never touched sort of the rotten fish curry. But then he got the whole dish of rotten fish curry and poured it into the bowl of pork curry. He started stirring up and saying, "It's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway. Mungan, Mungan." And I thought, the hypocrite. The liar, the fraud. Because if he really thought it was the same anyway, he would have mixed them up first before he took his. And now all my beautiful celebratory pork curry has been spoiled by this terrible, disgusting rotten fish. He can't get away with this. This is not fair. And that's what I realised. I was angry. And worse than anger, it meant I wasn't enlightened after all. And that you don't know how depressing that is. To think you're enlightened and suddenly find out you ain't. And that really spoiled my day. And after that, basically, I didn't care what I ate. I was just I was so upset, just pour some in, pass it down. That was the day I became enlightened and became unenlightened very quickly afterwards. But it was actually the test, was what, do you get angry or not? And that was actually pointed out to me, you're not enlightened yet, Ajahn. So it's important, that's actually how we find out, see if anger comes up. Lust is actually easier to suppress than anger. Because anger is very easy to come up. You just poke somebody and it comes. That's actually how you find out if someone's enlightened or not. Yeah, no, it really depends actually, because sometimes, you know, because I'm only irritating, but you know, you can actually see whether it's really anger or not. Obviously, there's the signs of being ill at ease because of a fever or sickness or hurting pain, but you know, that's different than your mental rejection of it. So it's the mental ill will, and you can certainly see it sort of when people really get angry, and that's, you know, a dead giveaway. And I was angry there. It wasn't irritation, I was angry. So that's actually how you usually find out if someone's enlightened or not. Really upset them. Not really irritated. Well, it depends actually. It's a level of irritation they can't go beyond. Because irritation is a big word. You know, irritation is just like having a sore, which is irritable. But you know, there's sometimes which is the difference between anger and irritation. It's a hard line to draw. But you know, if they're really shouting at you, you stupid woman, then that's anger. And you know it's anger, because you know it's certain. But when it's sort of a little irritation, then you don't really know for sure. Yes. I don't know, actually. I never actually saw him really ferocious or screaming at anybody. Like even when we kicked out Ajahn, it was just almost like for fun. He was obviously not angry, just teaching him a lesson. But not angrily. I never actually saw Ajahn get angry. I must admit that after all those years. Even though that he had much reason to get angry sometimes, what he had to put up with. But no, I never saw him. Venerable Ajahn, what is it that the self knew, which is one of the most difficult concepts to understand. Why is it that self-view, okay. Why is it that self-view, which is one of the most difficult concepts to understand, is included in the first stage of enlightenment rather than the later stage? Great question. Because in the whole cognitive process, your view is the first one to get corrected. And after the view is corrected, all the rest start to fall into place. I usually give a similar like people who are smokers. You think you have the view that smoking is bad for your health, but you don't give it up because you really don't have that view. You don't really know it to the core. But if you really understood that smoking is actually a stupid thing to do, it's bad for your health, what are you doing it for? If you really understood it, then the process of giving it up begins from that point. But it doesn't, you can't just give it up straight away. You've got to have the nicotine patches or counselling or whatever, and you go through the whole process of giving up what you know is bad for you. So the view comes first. Once you have the right view, then it reconditions the cognitive process. Once you have the right view of non-self, you know exactly what suffering is, you never think what's happiness is suffering, or you never view it again. You know what's impermanent, you know this mind, this knower and stuff, exactly what it is. But then, because of your mindfulness is not always, it hasn't been really developed to the full yet, you can forget sometimes that your perceptions and thoughts are conditioned by your habitual tendencies from before. rather than the tendencies which should be developing from your new right view. The new right view is there, but it hasn't fully kicked in to every thought and every perception. That's why you have a training. Once you see the truth, you've got to train yourself to make sure that truth stays in your mind at all times. That you know there's no one in here. You know you can't control things. So eventually you stop getting angry. You stop craving for things. There's no one in here. You keep that in mind all the time. And that's another description of continuous mindfulness. Continuous mindfulness with wisdom. Sati sampajanya. So you're mindful of this, and you know exactly it's nothing to do with me, not mine. So you leave it alone. And that's the arahant. The stream winner has got perfect right view, but they haven't got perfect thinking yet. The second factor of the Eightfold Path, Samasankhapa, is not perfected. Sometimes they'll think right thoughts, sometimes they won't think right thoughts. That's why a stream winner can still get angry or have lust or stuff his mouth full of cake or whatever else he's into. But they always realise, oh, I shouldn't have done that, it's the wrong view. But eventually the right view of a stream winner just starts to permeate, and Samasankhapa, the right thought, becomes perfected. So you never think thoughts of sensory desire or ill will or harming. Once that happens, that the virtue is perfected, the next factor of the Eightfold Path, and also at that point mindfulness is very strong, samadhi happens also. So the anagami has actually perfected the Eightfold Path. They've got the perfection of samadhi, four jhanas whenever they want. But there's two more factors which are necessary yet. They're called the Tenfold Path, which is the release of freedom and the knowledge of freedom. And that's just a slight difference between the anagami wading to shore and standing on the shore. There's hardly any difference at all. So if you just manage to be an anagami, that's good enough. Arahat's even better. But there's so little difference between them. Yeah, because all from the avidya, from the delusion of a self, and that you can own these things, that's lobha, it's my wife, and the delusion that this is really pleasure when it's suffering, and that gives you desire for things which, no, it's not going to help you out at all.
So then it doesn't show the jhana state like that. You still like that. Sometimes you can like, when we would say that you actually have like a status of avijja, but it looks like you still have some jhana state, you still have low tosa, isn't it?
Afterwards, when the jhana disappears. So you only get rid of the view which causes lobha and dosa at stream winner. The thoughts of lobha and dosa get rid of at anagami. But you still have the craving for the jhanas, the slight little piece of being left, that last little bit of avijja, the bhava dhanha or bhavasava, especially at arahat. Karmasava, the outflowing because of sensory desire, is destroyed at anagami. Bhavasava, the last of the outflowing, so just to be, that's destroyed at arahat. But you will find that out for yourself eventually. That's not a joke. The Ajahn. Is it possible to lead a lay life once you attain the first stage of enlightenment? Does seeing the Dharma mean eradication of self-view, or that you have seen self-view and still practice to eradicate self-view? I just mentioned the answer to the last part. You've seen the selflessness, but you have to just to practice to make that, you keep it in mind every moment. In other words, you actually have to train to have perfect thoughts, perfect mindfulness. But you can lead a lay life once you attain the first stage of enlightenment. Many lay people in the time of the Buddha were streamers. But you'll be a very good person. You won't be able to go down the pub if you become a streamer. So there's many things which you used to do you won't be able to do anymore. So it doesn't mean you go and do as much as you possibly can before you become a stream winner. That's not the right message. Ajahn Brahm, is it possible to attain a jhana without going through the bright light nimitta, e.g. falling into a huge black hole space? It is possible, but it is uncertain, unreliable, and you're not really quite sure what's actually happened. If you go through the nimitta stages, it's very easy to know where you are and what's happened. And if you come up to me afterwards and you say you've got this very deep experience, very peaceful, very blissful, you couldn't feel the body, no thoughts, if you're going through the nimitta, it's very easy for me as a teacher to say, yeah, see, this is what happens. But if you've gone through another way, sometimes you could delude yourself, and it's very hard to actually to confirm for sure yes or no. That's why the nimitta stage is just a way of seeing the process. You always go through the same process to enter a jhana, but if you go through the nimittas, you're actually seeing the landmarks. If you see the landmarks and develop the noticing the landmarks, it's very easy to know where you are. That's why I keep on encouraging person. You know, you may have got a jhana, I don't know. It could have been. May have, sometimes I might encourage you. It sounds like it was. Well done. But next time, try and develop the jhana, the nimittas. Look for them as you're going in. They're there, but you haven't noticed them. And if you notice them, then it's much easier to know exactly what you're doing, and it makes the whole process of entering a jhana much easier. You're going along the authorized route rather than taking shortcuts. But yeah, you can do, but not recommended. The Ajahn at 3:45 this afternoon. I could not keep my mind still. I thought it was going to be sort of something happening then. I asked my body what it wants, and the reply was Big Mac. The next line is classic. Should I go to McDonald's for the sake of all sentient beings? You mean you'll get 50 McDonald's Big Macs and share them out with all of us? Jokes aside, how do you apply checks and balances to your own justification? For example, delaying practice till I am retired. It's a great question. Okay, you've got to be honest with yourself and be rebellious, because this is one of the problems here, that most people are motivated enough, and so those actually questions don't happen. No one actually does go out and get McDonald's. You could do if you wanted to. No one will see you. But the point is, you feel terrible about it afterwards, and you think, "Oh, what did I do this for? You spoiled it." So the point is, you trust everybody not to do that, and trust yourself as well. So this is why, when you ask your body, if it gives a stupid answer like that, so you know you're not sort of asking it properly. You're just getting, you ask a stupid question, you get a stupid answer. But if you ask, what do you really want, body? What's allowable? What's possible? And they might just say, I just need some sustenance. And, well, you have an orange juice, or maybe a bit of cheese or something. Will that do you? You go, oh, okay, that'll do. So you can actually ask the body, but if it says Big Mac, just come off it. Get real. Should monks attain a spiritual level in Arahat before they start setting up monasteries, or maybe even start teaching other monks? In your opinion, what's the entry requirement to start a monastery, set up a monastery? That's a tough question. As long as you are stable in your faith in Buddhism, and you've got enough stability, because one of the You know that I never set up Bodhinyana Monastery. I was number two monk. Ajahn Jaco was number one monk. And I was having a wonderful time until he announced he was going to leave and eventually disrobe. Ah! And you know, obviously that I was the next in line to be the abbot, and that's what happened. But before I'd accept that, you know, I'd really look very deeply into my sort of my character and ask myself, like, are you likely to disrobe yourself? And I asked that question very seriously, because if there was any likelihood I was going to disrobe, I didn't want to do to others what I saw happen when Ajahn Jaco disrobed. That just really shocked a lot of people and destroyed a lot of their faith. And I know you've known me for a long time, many of you. And if, like tomorrow, you heard Ajahn Brahm was disrobed and married his 16-year-old girl, and you would be quite right to get very upset at me. You know, we looked after you, we had faith in you, we'd given you all this stuff, and this is what you've gone and done. So, there's no way you could actually harm people, because as you, if you're a monk, especially if you're a leader, you've got to be sincere. And if you haven't got that sincerity, if you're going to be liable to actually to raise people up and give them lots of inspiration and faith, and not being able to actually to fulfill the task, that's really lots of bad karma, because you're destroying people's faith. And that's one of the worst things you can destroy. You can destroy their life, but destroying their faith is worse. So that's what I had to do. I looked and then, first of all, make sure that you're very sure you're never going to disrobe before you set up a monastery and become a teacher. And then to see that if you understand the Dhamma, because it's going to be tough being a teacher. And everybody's going to be testing you out, asking you the toughest of questions. If you haven't got good answers, then it's going to be difficult for you. But, you know, be quite frank, I don't think you have to be fully enlightened to be a good teacher. You have to have something, though. You have to have some deep understanding, at least in some degree of faith, very good precepts, and some knowledge about your mind and meditation. Much of it you can learn on the job. And sometimes just have a humility, and just sometimes say, I don't know, is sometimes enough. And people respect you for that. Because in a monastery, or a nunnery, or whatever place it is, we're very fortunate, at least we've got the Buddha's teachings, the suttas. And these days you can have all these monks and nuns and CDs. You get so much information these days. And sometimes, so if you haven't got a resident teacher, you've got all these visiting teachers on MP3. So the access to the Dhamma is unprecedented in our age. Sometimes it's just having a community which is misled by somebody, you know, who's keeping the Vinaya respectful and respectable. It's sometimes enough. And if you are a group, because I remember this was the story of one of the great monasteries in the time of the Buddha, one I always keep as a standard. The monastery where Venerable Kimbala, Aniruddha, and Nandiya were living. And there's just the three of them together. When they first were there, none were an arahat, but they were living there together, supporting each other, practicing together. And when the Buddha came to visit them, they had a gatekeeper, said, keep out, there's just three people who are meditating here, three monks. They didn't recognize the Buddha. And when actually, I think one of them heard the Buddha's voice and rushed out and told the gatekeeper, that's the Buddha, that's our teacher, let him in. We don't mind being disturbed by the Buddha. And then the Buddha came in and sort of he talked to them. He said, what are you doing? How are you doing? And they say that whenever we go on alms round, whoever comes back, whoever leaves, or whoever goes first or whatever, puts out all the stuff, whoever comes last cleans up. We never talk to each other unless we really need to. If we really want something to move, we make sign language. And just once every 3 or 4 days, we meet together to discuss Dhamma. That's all we do. And the Buddha really praised that as a perfect monastery, where the whole time they were just practicing, hardly talking. Just once every 3, 4, 5 days, just meeting together to discuss Dhamma. And then, I think the Buddha came back later, and they were all enlightened with psychic powers. They didn't have a teacher there. The teacher just came and then just left. But they had the facilities, and they used those facilities wisely. So you don't need a teacher around all the time, but you certainly need the facilities there, the inspiration, and a little bit of guidance. And everyone has that. They have so much guidance. They have all the teachings. At the time of the Buddha, sometimes people just one talk, and that was enough. They get enlightened. These days, hundreds of talks, thousands of CDs. You get these iPods. I don't know how many sort of talks they got on that. That was enough to enlighten thousands of people in the old days. Now they can't even enlighten one person. So we have the information, but what we like is actually the, very often, the facilities and the time to practice. And sometimes these monasteries or hermitages or retreat centres, they give you the opportunity, the facilities and the time. You have the teachings, you have the facilities, now you can go and do it. Should the that's a great question, very important question, because it happens in some of the, my mind, should we go off by ourselves, can I send you to start a monastery? They say, no, I'm not ready yet. When will you be ready? When I'm an arahat. Sometimes that's too late. Sometimes you can actually make a lot of progress when you're teaching. That's actually one of the times when you can achieve enlightenment or stage of enlightenment, when you're teaching. You had the jhanas before, but when you're teaching other people, you're listening to what you're saying. You go, well, that makes sense. So some people got enlightened when they were teaching. The ajahn, is the act of keeping the five precepts solely to prevent one from falling into the lower realms? No, the five precepts, the best part of it, is to empower your mind so you can become a stream winner. That's the best part of the precepts, to enhance and empower your meditation. At the ordination ceremonies for monks, one of the things which I chant is Silang Paribharito Samadhi Mahapalo Hoti Mahani Sangso Samadhi Paribharita Panya Mahapalo Hoti Mahani Sangsa Panya Paribharitang Chitang Samadeva Asawehi Vimuchati, which means, as you all know, don't you? No. It means when samadhi is accompanied with precept, with virtue, it is of great power, of great benefit. When wisdom, panya, is accompanied with samadhi, with jhanas, it is of great power and great benefit. And when the mind, the citta, is empowered with such wisdom, it becomes enlightened. And that's actually what I chant at every ordination ceremony. Because when you have your ordination, it's not just a ritual, you've got some very powerful Dhamma involved in that. And that's beautiful teachings. When you are empowered with virtue, your samadhi takes off. It becomes like an energy source. And you see that especially when you get nimittas, because those nimittas, if you kept virtuous precepts for a long time, your nimitta is beautiful. It's amazing. That's the purity of your mind. If you kept precepts, if you haven't kept the precepts, the nimitta comes up, it's yucky, and you cannot deny it. You see it very clearly. So that's what I say is the purpose of sila, to empower samadhi. Okay. Next question. Last question. Oh, 10 past 9. Some of us, maybe our bad karma, have to support very demanding and stubborn sangha. Is that us? Oh, I do apologise, I'm very, very stubborn and demanding. How can we support them without creating unwholesome karma thoughts? Okay, the Buddha actually said that even if it's somebody wearing a robe, you know, of the sangha, just look at the robe, what it represents, what it signifies. So you're not giving it to the person, you're giving it to the institution. This is like the memory, the echo of the Buddha. This is a monk or a nun. Because sometimes, you know, is it really a stubborn sangha or demanding? Sometimes you don't really know who you're giving alms to, because they don't wear a special label, you know, I am an arahat or I'm a stream winner. And sometimes you can miss it. There was this old monk. This is Lungpu Dun, not Ajahn Dun. This Lungpu Dun died a long time ago, 2 or 3 years ago. And there was this very old man living in the northeast. I visited him a couple of times. And he was an arahat, but no one knew. He was just this old monk. He would just actually walk into the village for alms and walk out again and just stay by himself, meditating, having great fun. This is when actually Ajahn Yanadama went to see him once. And I saw him a couple of times afterwards. And Ajahn Yana was talking to him, and they're just talking about all sorts of things. And for some reason, they said, "Where do you live?" "I live down in Australia." He said, "I heard there's some, like this Antarctic or something down there." He said, "Yeah, it was full of ice." "Ice? And the whole country?" "Yeah, the whole country is like full of ice." And they had this little conversation. The following morning, he said, "Oh yeah, you know, you're right, Ajahn Yana." "What do you mean I'm right? I went there last night." So he's just going to check it out. So yeah, these are powerful monks. When they say things like that, you know, just sort of, you know, they're not trying to impress anybody, just a matter of fact. So this is this great monk with all these psychic powers. No one knew about him. And so sometimes it's like that. Sometimes you don't know. You think it might be just this old monk. They're very good monks and always nice and peaceful and kind. But sometimes you just don't know. But if they really are demanding and say, "Give me a Mercedes, give me a Rolex, gimme, 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 gimme," then it's not really a good monk. And that. Good. Tell them. Good, I agree with that. So if anything which I do wrong, tell me. They're bad jokes, Ajahn Brahm. You say, "I will not feed you, Ajahn Brahm." She's not telling the bad jokes. Whatever it is, but usually people like the bad jokes, so they still feed me. And that, I must be doing the right thing because people feed me a lot. Now the point is, in this Kosambi episode, the monks were fighting. They were just arguing over the most stupid of things. Actually, whether you should, before you use the toilet, you should have the water dip, or whether you should fill out the water jar, not fill out the water jar in the toilet. Now this is the small thing, like the chicken and duck thing, which I keep on saying. And one thing led to another, and it split the whole sangha. And half the sangha were not talking to the other; they were actually arguing. And as soon as the Buddha heard this, he wanted to come and sort it out, be the mediator. And what happens when you get angry? You just don't know what you're doing. You're crazy. The Buddha came along and the monk said, "Look, you leave this to us. You go off and meditate, Buddha. We will sort this out." And they wouldn't even listen to their teacher. That's what happens when you get angry. You know, whoever the senior monk is, you just don't listen to them. And so the Buddha never had any power. So he went off to the Parilaika forest. That's where he was looked after by the elephant and the monkey. And because the Buddha left Kosambi, the teacher had just arrived. And because of the bad actions of the monks, he left immediately without giving a talk. And so the people were very, very upset at their monks. And so they met together and said, "How can we teach these monks a lesson?" And it was very easy. Don't feed them. They had an agreement, the whole town, no one was to give any alms, not even a grain of rice, to any monk. So the monks went on alms round in the morning, they got absolutely nothing. No monk got anything. No one came to the monastery to feed the monks. And after about 4 or 5 days of that, it was amazing. They ended their argument. Hunger was more important than being right or wrong. And that was the lay people. They sorted the problem out. And really, you have immense power over the monks and nuns. You don't realize how much power you have. Just don't support them. And that way, and this is just the nature of the Sangha, what it should be. The problem these days is monks have their own money. So if you don't feed them, then they're the ones who go to McDonald's and buy their own Big Macs. And that means that you have got no power over them anymore. That's what happens when you give them money. In the old days, monks had to rely every day on the food of the faithful. That's how we rely these days in our monasteries. So certainly in our monasteries, you've got full power over us. You just don't feed us. And please do that, because it tells you, no, you're not doing the right thing. Yes, ma'am. Aha, Sarakadi, yeah. Yeah, he was a drunkard. He was like, it's a very strange story. But whatever, it's not an excuse for you to follow Sarakadi. Because what happens is sometimes people would ask him, you know, this supporter of yours, you know, was he enlightened? Was he a stream winner? Not only the Buddha could answer that. Now other people couldn't. That's why they always had to ask the Buddha whether his person was enlightened or not. Actually, someone once asked the Buddha, all these monks who say they're enlightened, are they all enlightened or are only some of them enlightened? Did they get it wrong? And the Buddha actually replied, look, some of them are enlightened, some of them aren't. Even I can't tell them they're not. Great answer. Even in the time of the Buddha, there were some monks claiming enlightenment and they were wrong. And the Buddha knew that, can do nothing about it. But for the stream winner, they asked the Buddha, this guy just died. He said, I was a stream winner. I said, what? And they started sort of complaining. They say, these days anyone can be a stream winner. In the old days, you had to be, at least keep the five precepts. Because he used to get into the drink. And it's uncertain from the Pali whether it meant the Buddha meant that at his death he became a stream winner or he was a stream winner before. For me, the Pali is ambiguous there. And for me, it's most likely that at his death he became a stream winner. Because of his precept, he couldn't have been really a stream winner during his life. But at his death, he had enough faith, enough wisdom, that he almost like sobered up at the last minute enough to see the Dhamma. Because I can't see how a stream winner would ever get addicted to alcohol. So I think the solution to Sarakadi is that at his death he became stream winner. That makes sense? So that's with stubborn and demanding Sangha. And the monks think, how do we deal with stubborn and demanding lay people? How can we support them? And the answer is with kindness, never with anger. Because if you give anger to stubborn and demanding lay people, you'll just get more stubbornness and anger back. But if you get kindness and gentleness, you change your lay supporters to also being like you, being kind and gentle. And it's exactly the same way. How do you deal with demanding and stubborn mind states? Have you got a stubborn mind? Have you got a demanding mind? Give me jhana, now. Give me peace, now. If you've got a stubborn and demanding mind, how do you deal with it? With kindness. There, mind. Never mind, mind. It's alright, mind. If you want sort of to go to sleep, that's alright, mind. If you want to think all sorts of stupid fantasies, that's alright, mind. If you do things like that, the mind, okay, I'll play with you. And then you can go into deep meditation. So that's how you deal with stubbornness and demanding, not with anger. As the Buddha said in the Dhammapada, anger does not cease with more anger, does it? So, if someone's angry to you, don't get angry back. Anger doesn't cease with more anger. It ceases with kindness. There, Mr. Bin Laden. There, Mr. Bush. Okay. Any other questions before we finish? Oh, this is... Okay, that's right, yeah. Oh, I haven't answered this question, sorry. Ajahn, do you have to be rid of ill will before... No, I did one. When does ego disappear because you've attained... I didn't answer these last two parts of this question. Sorry, last part. When does ego disappear? Because you had mentioned that even after attaining jhana, you can still be egotistical. It does not seem like jhana equals enlightenment, but the reverse is so. Okay, jhana is a path to enlightenment, but jhana isn't enlightenment. The ego completely finishes at arahat, fully enlightened. You've got no ego anymore, no sense of self. The anagami has just got a slight sense of ego. Thinks that, you know, he is the beautiful jhana states. But it's only a slight ego for the anagami. But the ego is fully gone with the arahat. Which is why the arahat can't say, I am enlightened. The I is gone. What they usually say is, what's done has been done. There is no more becoming. That's usually what they say. So, have you done what's needed to be done? Well, the night is still young. Do it before you are undone. Okay, it's late enough now. So, hope you enjoyed the stuff this evening. Nah, come on. Do it the Ajahn Brahm way. Sadhu. 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 There we go. See, it gives you energy. Ha ha ha.